Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
It is now my distinct pleasure to introduce this afternoon's speaker, Dr. Amir Eschel. Amir Eschel is professor of German Studies and Comparative Literature and the director of the Forum on Contemporary Europe at Stanford University. Born in Haifa, Israel, Amir Eschel completed his PhD at the University of Hamburg in Germany before arriving at Stanford University in 1998. Amir Eschel's work focuses on the German Jewish literary and philosophical tradition, on post-war German literature, on contemporary Hebrew prose, as well as on theoretical approaches to the study of memory and history. His first book, Zeit der Zäsur, Jüdische Lyriker im Angesicht der Shoah, offers a study of temporal forms in the work of Jewish poets facing the Shoah, such as Paul Celan, Nelly Sachs, Rosa Ausländer, Yehuda Amichai, among others. Currently, he is completing a book manuscript on the literary engagement with the past in the contemporary German, Israeli, and Anglo-American novel. Please help me welcome our distinguished speaker.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. It's a great pleasure and an honor for me to be here today to deliver a Georg Wittgenstein lecture in this hall. I would like to begin by thanking Professor Weber for inviting me and allowing me to receive this honor, and also to thank the entire Department of Germanic and Semitic, Germanic, Slavic, and Semitic Studies at the University of California in Santa Barbara. It is indeed a very special day for me because, as Elizabeth mentioned, I received my PhD at the University of Hamburg in Germany, but I began my studying at Germany at the University of Munich. And I still recall quite vividly how I was for the first time in the atrium of the University of Munich, the very place where the leaflets of the White Rose came down on the floor, the leaflets that brought to the arrest of the group. And I still remember that day as if it has been only yesterday. The lecture I will deliver today is a part of a larger project that looks at the literary and cultural engagement of the past, both in literature and in cinema, other forms of culture. And it looks at the two cultures I'm most familiar with, that is Germany of the period post-1945 and Israel of the era following 1948. Talking about the past in the German context, my question is, how did German literature and culture make sense, perceived, addressed the memory of National Socialism, the memory of Nazism, naturally the Holocaust? In the Israeli context, the question is, how does Israeli culture, literature, society deals with the memory of 1948? 1948, as we all recall, was the year in which the State of Israel was created. It's the year of the War of Independence. It was also the year in which approximately 750,000 Palestinians were either expelled or fled the country. So my question is, how does Israeli culture deals with the memory of that chapter of history? As Elizabeth mentioned, another part of the book deals with Anglo-American literature, and there I focus on the ways in which literature and culture deals in these very days with the memory of the attacks of September the 11th. So the larger question is history and memory and how we make sense of the past. My talk today centers on the German side of things, so with your permission, I would like to begin. On August 11th, 2006, in the midst of the summer lull, a confession shocked Germany. In an interview published in anticipation of his long-awaited autobiography, Beim Häuten der Zwiebel, Peeling the Onion, Nobel laureate Günter Grass revealed that he did not serve, as he previously claimed, in Nazi Germany's air defense, but rather in the tank division Jörg von Frundsberg of the notorious Waffen-SS. In Germany and around the world, writers and commentators rushed to react. The famous Austrian writer Peter Handke slashed Grass's confession as an act of self-righteous formality, a humiliation for the profession of writing. The much-celebrated poet Durst Grünbein saw in Grass's confession an attempt by the writer to distinguish himself from other German writers and thinkers. Grünbein thought that Grass's confession was an attempt by Grass to present himself, and I quote, as a real war horse. The young and successful Berlin-based writers Eva Menasse and Michael Kumpfmüller used the occasion to attack the older intellectuals who flocked to publish their comments in Germany's literary sections in the daily newspapers. For Menasse and Kumpfmüller, the dispute was nothing but, and I quote, a class reunion of all German intellectuals who feel chronically obliged to enlighten Germans on the same topic, Hitler and me. Please, no more confessions, demanded Menasse and Kumpfmüller. And I quote from their essay, are there no other topics? Where are the voices of the current political and moral issues? It's time for this country to finally liberate itself from the self-reflections of its onion-skinned Nazi past. It's time for the lessons of history preached 100 times to finally be applied to the politics of the 21st century. Let's talk about our relationship to Islam. Let's talk about the limits of liberty. It's about us and our future. End quote. In relating the 2006 Grass affair to an alleged German obsessive-compulsive relation to the past, Menasse and Kumpfmüller seem to me off the mark, as I hope to show. Their claim could, however, be somewhat explained through Günter Grass's own self-assessment of his generation's contribution to post-war German culture. Specifically, the claim bears on Grass's emphasis on this literature's particular sense of retrospection. Reflecting in his Nobel lecture of 1999 on the literary beginnings of the 1950s, the time where he first started published, Grass has underlined that he and his fellow writers of the legendary Group 47 have let the German language, quote-unquote, become memory, thus preventing the past from drifting into oblivion. In so doing, they kept the historical wound of Auschwitz opened and, quote, confronted the much desired and prescribed forgetting be reversed with a steadfast once upon a time, end quote. With his reference to literature's ability to confront the drive to forget, Grass reiterated the most common narrative concerning post-war German literature, the claim that its main concern has been to depict the crimes committed by Germans and to admit to guilt, or, more recently, to present the pains Germans themselves endured, most notably during the air raids on Germany's cities. Rarely reflected from a theoretical philosophical point of view, the notion of Vergangenheitsbewältigung, that is, coming to terms with the past, often implied that literature can somehow return to a particular moment in time and produce a viable and, in crucial ways, correct image of National Socialism. The author's intentions, the reading process, the work's reception, and the task of the literary critic were defined by their retrospective trajectory, that is, by questions such as, did the author or work face up to the past? Did she treat it in an oblivious manner? Does the poetic image reflect a responsible approach to Germany's history, that is, an acceptance of guilt, etc., etc.? In accordance with this ingrained approach, in the course of the 2006 Grass affair, the author's autobiographical work, that is, his actual literature, was almost never discussed, never on its own terms. More than one incisive critic was content with simply undoing the writer personally and thus dismiss his entire work. While I do not wish to take a position here in the debate surrounding Grasse's personality and politics, this is a very contentious topic, I do think that the affair can help us rethink a major trend in the study of contemporary German literature as it engages the past. The problem I see in many of the reactions to Grasse's book is that they reiterate the naive, interrelated assumptions that literature should or could adhere to epistemological criteria, that it primarily reflects the author's or her community's expressed or unconscious ethico-political convictions. Shortly, that the past is a masterable narrative, a masterable entity one can actually go back to and return with a representation that would imply that he or she have learned from the past. In other words, that he or she is capable of retrospection. And as we've seen, there is a variety of critics who are waiting there to judge if he or she mastered the task. In recent decades, this approach was molded into the psychoanalytical tableau. The literary works in question were often read as more or less successful cases of an authorial or societal working through or acting out. Literature's engagement with history was often understood as encoding and or decoding the writer or her community's ability to deal with traumas, with repression, successful overcoming, significant transference, and so on. Here again, the underlying assumption is that literature, as it engages the past, should be read along the fault line of what is appropriate or inappropriate in light of these psychoanalytic protocols. And there are many critics that are writing long books in which they divide the world between those authors who are able to work through or those who are still acting out. Some of these books are very interesting and inspiring. I would like to offer a different approach today. To be sure, National Socialism in its various manifestations is at the center of such major literary works as Günter Grass's The Tin Drum, Uwe Jonsson's Jahrestage, Ingeborg Bachmann's Todesarten. We can think of Günter Grass's Oskar Mazerat or Uwe Jonsson's Gesine Krespal. All of them are figures of thought in the tradition of Walter Benjamin. They signify the individual and communal attempt to narrativize historical events. At the same time, however, those figures, I will claim, allow us to reflect on social, political, and ethical issues pertinent to National Socialism. Again, it is not that they reflect those events, but, as I would like to suggest, they allow us reflection on these events. They are not a mirror image of the writer's conscience or unconscious. They are not a mirror image of what had happened, but rather an invitation for us to consider both the past and the writer's approach to the past. While I do not wish to undermine the significance of retrospection in the study of literature, I would like to suggest rereading the aforementioned works and those I will discuss today as both modes of retrospective encoding of the traumatic, but also as a figurative constellation that actually changes the prevalent lexis used to deal with the past. Allow me to dwell on this point for a while. Discussing Donald Davidson's theory of metaphor, the philosopher Richard Rorty noted that by putting metaphor outside the pale of semantics, by insisting that a metaphorical sentence has no meaning other than the literal one, Davidson lets us see metaphors on the model of unfamiliar events in the natural world, causes of changing beliefs and desires, rather than on the model of representations of unfamiliar worlds. Davidson lets us see the metaphors which make possible novel scientific theories as causes of our ability to know more about the world, rather than as expressions of such knowledge. He, Donald Davidson, thereby makes it possible to see other metaphors as causes of our ability to do lots of other things. For example, to see other metaphors, to discover the world anew, to emancipate ourselves, to get rid of outmoded traditions, transvaluate what's important to us, all these things without having to interpret the metaphors as cognitive abilities or presenting cognitive abilities. Richard Rorty then goes on to underline the role played in our lives by metaphorical expressions, which are not sentences, that is, by poetic expressions. Poetic expressions, Rorty notes, that send shivers down our spine. They do not represent the world to us, but rather cause us a certain sensation. Such phrases, such metaphors, reverberate endlessly, Rorty says. Indeed, they are capable of changing our patterns of action without ever coming to express belief or desire. When we will turn momentarily to a variety of literary works and examine their metaphors or ironies, we will do so while considering their role as causing change rather than representing past realities, as allowing us to emerge out of oblivion rather than to present historical events. Regardless of the author's intentions and views of the work, I will point out that these literary images of the past offers us, Germans and non-Germans alike, a new way to see, new in the sense of knowing more about ourselves, knowing about ourselves in a different manner, a different way. Shortly, they allow us to become. I would like to suggest rereading contemporary German literature's engagement of the past as what Rorty calls imaginative redescription. According to Rorty, writers and readers of literature reconstitute themselves through redescription, that is, by telling and retelling stories about where they come from and where they're going. That is, by developing new metaphors, ever-evolving vocabularies, new ways to look at the world. The writer is no more, but also no less, than the willful misreader of old languages and stale narratives. It is thus through the production of novel modes of expressions that writers and readers alike reconstitute themselves and the worlds they inhabit. As we now turn to prominent examples from the work of Günter Grass, Alexander Kluge, W.G. Sebald, and Katharina Hacker, we will see how in presenting new metaphors and new ways to view the past, literature allows us to reflect on ethical and political issues. It does so in a manner reminiscent of philosophy, namely, as a mode of what another philosopher, Hilary Putnam, calls reflexive transcendence, that is, not through providing a set of principles or commanding what lessons we must learn from the past, but rather as a way of standing back from conventional opinion on the one hand and the authority of revelation on the other hand, and ask, quite simply, why? So, where did German writers introduce new ways to interpret what occurred, what happened in the German past, and how did they create new vocabularies? Let us begin from the beginning. Let us go back to Günter Grass and his famous The Tindrum, arguably one of the most influential works of post-war German literature. The novel The Tindrum begins with the word, and allow me to quote the German, "Zugegeben, ich bin Insasse einer Heil- und Pflegeanstalt." In the English, "Granted, I'm an inmate of a mental hospital, a mental institution." The speaker is Oskar Mazerat, the 30-year-old narrator of the novel. Before Oscar goes on to present an immensely broad view of German history, of the preceding history, his overture indicates that all his images, observations, and judgments should be doubted. After all, how could anyone count on a narrator who resides in a mental hospital? Oscar thus both tells us of times past, but at the same time, he stands as the incarnation of doubt about his own story, in fact, about all stories. His sumptuous, picaresque language, his mixing of the ironic and the sentimental in the account of what happened, point at the contemporary condition, Germany of the 1950s. At the same time, it underlines that nothing, including such fascinating stories he has to offer, can be taken at face value. Leaving behind the arid realism so typical of the German post-war literature, so-called Kahlschlagliteratur, a literature of clear cutting, Grass creates, through Oskar Mazerat, a new lexis, a new language of substantial distrust toward a cultural and political discourse still marked by fascism. More than facing the past, confronting the past, representing the past, what Oscar does is to incarnate a new way to look at the present. He is the embodiment of disbelief in social norms, in ruling ideologies, in all forms of convention. In short, in the mental and institutional universe that surrounded him and Günter Grass himself while growing up in Nazi Germany, a universe that survived the war, at least partly, in West Germany of the 1950s. Günter Grass's imaginative redescription of the past introduced a general sense of doubt, and with that doubt helped to shape a public discourse that would eventually bring down the conservative elite of the immediate post-war era. A very different case is that of his fellow writer of the Gruppe 47, or Group 47 that I mentioned before, a writer by the name Alexander Kluge. Alexander Kluge is not only a writer, he's also a filmmaker and a social thinker. And in his works, in which he draws a lot on the philosophy of Theodor Adorno and his analysis of modernity, Kluge mixes both fictional and historiographical accounts together in one and the same artistic or novelistic creation. I would like, with your permission, to refer at this point to Alexander Kluge's work, The Air Raid on Halberstadt, on April 8, 1945. And I hope that technology will help me by so doing. So we have here the first page of Alexander Kluge's prose. I will say in a minute more about what I mean with prose, by the title The Air Raid on Halberstadt on April 8, 1945. What we have here in this prose is an assembly of both narrative, fiction, testimonies, photographs that were taken during the air raid on the city of Halberstadt, as well as the poster you see in front of you in this slide. Now, if I hope it's somewhat clear, you see that the story begins with brackets, square brackets, all the way up. And from these brackets, the story then continues onward. And then when you begin looking at this story, you also see the poster. What I'd like to do for a second is just to think about the way text and image are assembled together, how they really belong together when we approach the story. Upon approaching Alexander Kluge's narrative, we soon face his crucial formal choice. The destruction of the city of Halberstadt, by the way, this is also his hometown, the destruction of the city of Halberstadt is portrayed while the reader's gaze is fixed both on the text and on the poster of the movie Heimkehr, which was screened in one of the city's cinema at the 0 hour of the assault. we read, and now I quote from the square brackets all the way at the top, an interrupted matinee screening in Capitol, Sunday, April 8th, with the movie Heimkehr, with Paula Wessely and Attila Herbiger. The cinema belongs to the Lenz family. The theater's director and cashier is the sister-in-law, Frau Schrader. So you see, the language is very precise, very analytic. It's almost like a report, and this is how the story begins, or the prose, the narrative begins. Before describing how bombs shattered the cinema and the entire town, Kluger's constellation of text and image draws our attention to the film being shown during the attack. It is no other than Gustav Usicki's 1941 movie, Heimkehr, Homecoming. Commissioned by Goebbels in 1939, Usicki's film portrayed the fate of Germans living outside the borders of the Reich as the story of a beleaguered ethnic community whose survival is threatened by the Poles. The movie inverted the actual historical circumstances in describing the presumable persecution of Germans by Poles, casting, as Johannes von Moltke has shown, victims as perpetrators. Heimkehr's climax depicts, in fact, Germans carted away on flatbed trucks, and I quote, like animals. So in the movie, they are referred to as being carted away like animals. Those in the crowd watching the movie during the air raid on Halberstadt might have heard the Nazi film star Paula Wessely fantasize, and I quote from Paula Wessely's role in the script, quote, "Just think, people, what it will be like. Just think when around us there will be lots of Germans, and when you come into a store, people won't talk Yiddish or Polish, but German. And not only the whole village will be German, but all around, everything surrounding us will be German. And we will be right in the middle, inside, in the heart of Germany." The year is 1939, and it is before Germany invades Poland. Kluge's formal choice, of course, presents what occurred in the city of Halberstadt. This is the story of the destruction of Halberstadt by the Allies. But much more importantly, it introduces a new way to see the suffering of the German civil population during the air raids. German suffering was central to the view of National Socialism and of World War II in Germany of the immediate post-war era. Kluger's image redescribes Halberstadt's demise as a moment in a vast totality in which the pre-war politics, Nazi propaganda, and the suffering of the German civil population could be seen as related to each other. So the very constellation of these seemingly different elements bring them into one view, and it's impossible to separate the suffering that we will hear about or read about of the population from the movie and the entire ideology behind that movie. There is nothing sentimental or moralizing in Kluger's narrative, as his chilling irony clearly underlines. Let me give you an example of this irony, but I warn you that it doesn't sound as convincing in the English translation as it does in the German. So what I'll do is to quote both the German and the English. You remember Frau Schrader is the cashier sitting at the entrance of this cinema hall when the bombing occurs. Frau Schrader, upon the attack on the city, Frau Schrader discovers in the cellar of the cinema the bodies of six matinee guests who were trapped there during the air raid and literally boiled by steam coming out of the heating pipes in the cellar. Frau Schrader's reaction, in Kluge's words, and I quote, "Frau Schrader wanted to restore order at least here and place the loose cooked body parts which came apart either through the heating pipe's explosion or through the bombs in a laundry basket." That's the English, now the German. "Frau Schrader wollte wenigstens hier Ordnung schaffen,
legte die gekochten und entweder durch diesen Vorgang oder schon durch die Sprengwirkung unzusammenhängenden Körperteile in die Waschkessel der Waschküche. Now the language, the sound of unzusammenhängenden Körperteile in Waschkessel, in Waschküche, this sound, this language that comes here through this music is quite unique, and it's a part of the universe that Kluge tries to address here and in a way criticize. By opting for irony, Kluge's text clearly exceeds the realm of coming to terms with the events at Halberstadt in the sense of representing them, providing very little that would serve as context and explanatory framework. The narrative is a point of departure for reflection on the conditions that enabled such mental constellations, as are evident in Frau Schrader. She wanted to restore order in the cellar. What the narrative does is to offer reflection, that is, reflection on the social, political, and cultural circumstances that led to, but also persisted through, the air raid of April 8, 1945. As a follower of critical theory, that is the Frankfurt School, Kluge's prose displays the air raid as the possible working of instrumental reason. However, and this is the writer's achievement, his text commands no finite meaning, no commanding lesson. On the contrary, the horror of Halberstadt's fall comes into view as a moment in a history of human cruelty and inhumanity, whose borders go back in time to the beginning of recorded history and stretch well into the present. Kluge's air raid on Halberstadt ends, indeed, with a reference to a study that was apparently conducted in the city by the American military in May of 1945, and a statement made by one of the interviewees. Now imagine this collage of text and posters, text and photographs. The whole thing ends then with a quote from this study conducted by the Americans, and one of the people questioned says simply this, and I quote, "As of a certain point of cruelty, it doesn't matter who began. It should simply stop." Without falling back on moralism, the sentence remains a quotation in a collage. The narrative presents an event that occurs in the present, it should simply stop, and demands thinking vis-a-vis the future. It should simply stop, continues to sound even when the last survivor of the air raid had long passed away. The conditions for stopping catastrophes such as that of Halberstadt remained, however, the subject of future thought and possible human action. Though only 12 years younger than Alexander Kluge, the writer W.G. Sebald belongs to a different literary generation altogether. While Kluge experienced National Socialism as a young adult, Sebald came to age in Konrad Adenauer's Germany, in a culture he himself described as one of all-encompassing oblivion. Oscillating, like Alexander Kluge, between fact and fantasy, Sebald's prose is written in the first person singular. He always writes as if he himself would be speaking, refraining from the distant position of an all-knowing narrator in the vein of the 19th century realistic novel. His narrating eye is challenged by the wish to retell what is going on, but also by the years that passed since the historical event. In what is surely his magnum opus, the novel Austerlitz, Sebald's narrator reports of his 1967 excursion to the Belgian fortress of Brendonck, a structure that was used during World War II by the SS. The scene of the narrator's visit to the fortress of Brendonck culminates in the concrete evocation of what occurred in the cellars of that fortress during the 1940s, and I quote from Austerlitz, "But I do remember that there, in the casement at Brendonck, a nauseating smell of soap rose to my nostrils, and that this smell was linked to the bizarre German word for scrubbing brush, Wurzelbürste, which was a favorite of my father's and which I had always disliked. Black striations began to quiver before my eyes, and I had to rest my forehead against the wall. It was not that, as the nausea rose in me, I guessed at the kind of third-degree interrogations which were being conducted here around the time I was born, since it was only a few years later that I read Jean Améry's description of the tortures he suffered in Brendonck when he was hoisted aloft by his hands, tied behind his back, so that with a crack and a splintering sound, his arms dislocated from the sockets in his shoulder joints, and he was left dangling as they were wrenched up behind him and twisted together above his head. End quote. The 1940s are surely no longer at hand, yet through Sebald's poetic language, they appear to us very close. You remember he enters the casement and the whole section I just quoted is in the present tense. The crux in the paragraph's employment of presence effects, that is, creating the illusion that worlds of the past are tangible again, is what drives us through this scene. Yet another element is very important. Amery's humiliation, Jean Amery was interned in this casement, is both remembered as such and comes into view through a distressful bodily aspect of the life world of the narrator, a German who, like Sebald himself, was born during the time Amery and others were subjected to Nazi torture. You remember he talks about the moment he was born. The moment he was born is also the moment where this person was tortured in the casement. Now, he tells this story in the present. Everything still happens at the moment. This is the drama, I would argue, of this section. The there and then becomes an element of the here and now. Soon after invoking Amery's torture at Brendonck, the narrator, in fact, goes on to mention another inmate, Gaston Novelli, for whom the time there and then never ceased. Taking the form of a fixation on a timeless procession of screens of an endless chain of the letter A. Now, you remember what Kluge did with his collage of text and image. When we hear about, when we read about the song of the lead in this section of the story, and when we hear about the screening, we have these three lines of the letter A. So the narrative disallows us, or prevents us from just continuing on as if those screens belong to the past, and really forces us to dwell on this very strange-looking lines of game. This screening is not just told, you're not just reading a story about the screen, we have to, in a way, use ourselves in this screen of aims and experience, I would argue, while doing so, what it means to be tortured over time in the casement. While encoding the traumatic, the experiences of Amery and Novelli, Sebald's novel takes on with formal devices, such as those we observe here in the image, what the narrator explicitly fears. The narrator of the novel Austerlitz constantly talk about the fact that the world is draining itself, in that the history of countless places and objects which themselves have no power of memory is never heard. And his role is to bring those places, to bring objects that have themselves no memory to life through this artistic creation. The result is a prose that dramatizes the proximity between what had occurred in the distant past and the present as one single continuum. Sebald's issue is not simply to decipher the belatedness of a past that haunts the present, rather his prose employs sounds, like that of the splintering arms and images like that of the A, that we spend much time gazing on, that stop the flow of time and force us to really engage with them. The historical becomes a challenge for the reader now, during the moment of reading. The philosopher Avishai Margalit asks in his recent book, The Ethics of Memory, and I quote, "What should humanity remember?" His answer is, quite simply, striking examples of radical evil and crimes against humanity. Austerlitz's sounds and images turn Nazism into an experience as close and as intimate as what we sensed a moment ago. Presenting torture in Brendonk, it is just the same a meditation on torture as such. While recent German history remains vivid through personal experience for writers like Alexander Kluge and W.G. Sebald, for the 40-year-old writer Katharina Hacker, it is accessible only through the accounts of others. This condition determines the framework of her novel Eine Art Liebe, A Kind of Love, which was published in the year 2003. In this novel, we encounter the 30-something German writer, Sophie. Sophie studied in the Hebrew University in the 1990s. When the novel begins, she returns to Israel to visit a much older friend, the lawyer Moshe Fein. 3 weeks earlier, Moshe Fein's childhood friend, Jean, was found dead in a Berlin pub, in a Berlin Kneipe. After visiting Moshe in his Jerusalem apartment, Sophie asks him to take her to the bus station so she can go back to her hotel. It is then that Moshe addresses her with the following words, and I quote, "I give you Jean's story as a gift. Write it down. Ich schenke dir Jean's Geschichte. Schreib sie auf." In the following pages, Sophie will unpack this offering. She will write down what Moshe tells her of Jean's life. While telling that story, Moshe also accounts for his own life. He goes back to the 1940s, to the time, that is, when he and Jean attended a Catholic boarding school in Vichy, France. Jean came to the boarding school as a French Catholic. Born in Charlottenburg, Berlin, in the 1930s, Moshe Fein landed in that Catholic boarding school as a Jewish youth escaping the Nazis. Having converted to Catholicism in that boarding school, Moshe grew up as Jean-Marie. Only after the war did he learn that his parents were murdered in Auschwitz. He discovered Zionism and moved to Israel. As Sophie, the young German studying in Jerusalem, struggles to piece together the mosaic of Moshe's and Jean's life, she also needs to define her own position. Narrating the lives of others, she will also tell of her own life, her own experience in Israel and in Germany of the 1990s. She will do so while evoking the crimes of Vichy France, touching on the German post-war era, and reflecting on contemporary Middle Eastern politics. Constantly shifting her temporal perspective, Sophie's account makes use of the multivalent German noun Geschichte. The distant past, Nazism as Geschichte, as history, is woven into the writing of life, the writing of biography as eine Geschichte, a story. Furthermore, since Moshe Fein has forgotten or repressed many details of his life, he urges Sophie to imagine, indeed to invent, I quote, invent, parts of her account. That is, to regard the Geschichte he gave her as an invitation to bring the lives of the Jewish survivor and his Catholic friend to bear on her own. And I quote Sophie, "Moshe's story, Jean's story, and my own are constantly mixed now." In imagining and inventing the story, Katharina Hacker recasts the metaphoric associated with the German noun Geschichte. Geschichte is not a moment one can return to, a coherent reservoir waiting to be excavated, confronted, mourned, etc. Rather, it is the ephemeral threads of texts, verbal memories, testimonies, remnants, and so on that are waiting to be used, to be made useful in narrative form. What cannot be imagined and utilized might indeed be eternally forgotten. As Sophie approaches the end of her account, she acknowledges to Moshe, and I quote, "It is not what you expected." She's deeply disappointed by what she produced. However, it's interesting to hear what Moshe has to tell her. Reiterating his preliminary gesture, Moshe replies, "I didn't expect anything. It is your story. I gave it to you as a present." The marked past is here hardly a burden to be carried. It is not only the traumas we are forced to work through. Hacker's metaphor of history as a gift makes such language as facing the past, measuring the shadow or the abyss, etc., obsolete. Those of you who speak German in the audience and who know the discourse in Germany of the post-war era are very familiar with expressions like Auseinandersetzung mit der Geschichte, Last der Vergangenheit, Schatten der Vergangenheit, all these images that are very prevalent and really make up the ways many address the past. What literature does, I try to offer here to your consideration, is quite different, and Sophie is a good example. Her past, Sophie's past, is a potent endowment waiting to be used in the process of creating one's own life story. It is through the adaptation of Geschichte, including the story of the victims and survivors, that their fate becomes tangible. But even more importantly, it is through adding Sophie's own sentences to those of Moshe, Jean, and the others that Sophie herself becomes. She changes in the course of the attempt to write the story, to write their Geschichte. Once all narration ends, the reader finds a note written by the author herself. It is here that Katharina Hacker discloses that what many might have guessed all along, that the story of Moshe Fein is closely related to that of Saul Friedlander's in his memoir, When Memory Comes. Eine Art Liebe, my novel, A Kind of Love, Katharina Hacker writes, and I quote, deals with the question, how is it possible to understand with the help of the imagination? There, where one has no memory. She doesn't have any memory because she was born after the war. And she continues, how to remember regardless of what time will bring. There always exists the unrelenting attempt to understand and the imagination. What she has to her disposal is the unrelenting attempt to understand and the imagination. This is exactly what the novel performs. Sophie's attempt to piece together the story of Moshe Fein and Jean emerges as the result of her desire to understand. To understand in the sense of achieving an instructive image of times past. Understanding does not mean here coming up with an epistemologically grounded knowledge or pieces of knowledge one can take with oneself and move on. On the contrary, Katharina Hacker's novel displays a heightened awareness of our contemporary historical consciousness, namely, to the fact that history appears to us often as a mere sublime desire, as Amy Elias recently noted. The crucial issue is how to relate to a past that is only given to one, that one did not experience personally. Hacker's answer is quite simply imagination. No longer the reservoir of lessons and insights the past requires of us more than the retrospective focusing on what will always remain absent. It demands the prospective incorporation of the lives of others into one's own, albeit without effacing the difference between them. Katharina Hacker, Sophie, values her gift not out of reverence to the historical, but rather since she's able to make use of history for the sake of her life today, for her own future, be it in Berlin or as a German living in Jerusalem. Post-war German literature, ladies and gentlemen, deserves much more attention than give it to it when we are asking how it represents Nazism or the air raids on German cities. When asking if the writer was able to mourn or repress yet again in perpetual acting out. As we have seen in our discussion in this lecture today, the dubious and the doubt-casting Oskar Matzerath, the analytical, ironic narrator of Alexander Kluge's prose, W.G. Sebald's all-encompassing eye, and Katharina Hacker's Sophie are capable of much more than indicating the ability of Germans to remember or to forget, to be heroes or mere war horses, as Durst Grünbein claimed about Grass. These writers and their literature expand the language, and with it, the life worlds German readers and readers elsewhere inhabit. At times, they even allow these readers to imagine inhabiting these very life worlds in a different manner altogether. Offering what we called an imaginative redescription of the past, they participate in the writing and rewriting of the present and maintain an ethical horizon, whereas ethics is understood here not as a system of guiding principles, but rather as a web of interrelated concerns, dilemmas, challenges we need to debate, problems we attempt to solve, torture being one very important of them. Kluge's ongoing literary work, the deepening reception of Sebald's writing, Katharina Hacker's self-reflexive novels, and the prose of writers we did not discuss today, such as Marcel Bayer, Norbert Stein, Tanja Dückers, or Kevin Fenneman, demand that we proceed in the much-needed re-evaluation of post-war German literature. They call on us to move beyond the question of proper or improper confrontation with history, to see the past in its horrific manifestations, but also, and here lies my emphasis, as an endowment, as an invitation to a productive, prospective engagement with what is and with what lies ahead. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.